Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. You can call in with questions for our guests during the second half hour of the show. Just dial 917-388-4520, then press 1. And I'll try and give you a little reminder about halfway through the show. Our guests tonight are Netta DeMayo, founder and president of Return to Freedom, and Corey Golden, the Advocacy and Communications Director of Return to Freedom. Netta's going to be calling in a bit late. She was delayed, but she will be trying to call in at some point during the show. Return to Freedom was founded in 1997 and is dedicated to preserving the freedom, diversity, and habitat of America's wild horses through sanctuary, education, advocacy, and conservation. Welcome to the show, Corey.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, right off the bat, we're going to start off with the big elephant in the room. Can you tell our listeners what's in the president's 2018 budget that will harm wild horses and burros, and how will it harm them?
Yeah, so let's start with the bad news. So what's in the budget? There's some provisions that remove protections for wild horses and burros. And it's the kind of thing, like in these 3,000-page budgets, that can really fly under the radar. And so we're doing all we can, and I know other advocacy organizations are too, to try to bring this to the public's attention. For starters, the budget would cut the Bureau of Land Management's Wild Horse and Burro Program by about 12%, so about $9.7 million. Currently, the majority of the program's budget goes to warehouse about 47,000 captured wild horses and burros in short or long-term government holding facilities. The budget would cut those costs by allowing the Bureau of Land Management to conduct sales without limitation, which means eliminating the current policy of captured wild horses and burros being offered for sale without limitation when they reach age 10 or when they fail to be adopted 3 times. So they would, any of the captured animals would be free to be sold without limitation. And so many of those sold would likely fall into the hands of kill buyers and be trucked to Mexico or to Canada. Another important thing, the budget would also remove language restricting the BLM's ability to use all of the management tools authorized in the 1971 Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burro Act. Basically what that means is that all along during the past, you know, X number of years, Congress has added language in appropriations bills and spending bills that barred the Bureau of Land Management from shooting healthy animals. That includes even the omnibus spending bill that was passed this spring. Congress there again said, you know, you can't euthanize healthy animals, and that's the spending bill that gets us through September. So we feel as though that what they're asking for is flies in the face both of what Congress has been saying for many years, which is we don't want healthy horses euthanized. And we can talk about this a little bit, but euthanize is really a kind of a soft way of saying shoot. And and so that's, it flies in the face of Congress clearly stating that in the spring, and also, you know, time and again, the American people have stood up for America's wild horses and burros. You look at surveys and polls, and, you know, 80% or more of Americans will say that they don't want horses slaughtered. They don't want to see bad things happen to wild horses. And so our challenge is, as advocates, is that there's so much going on in D.C. at the moment, the fight over health care and other things, that's very difficult to cut through all the noise. And I say those are worthwhile subjects to be fighting about as well. But wild horses and burros are kind of getting lost in that at the moment. And
well, especially
so,
since this is such an epic proposal to slaughter so many tens of thousands, I mean, like almost 90,000 or something. It's an epic proposal. It's huge. And
yeah,
it takes away all the protections. Corey,
absolutely.
I don't know if you remember, did you ever see the internal working documents a group called Patricia Haight of the Conquistador Foundation. I think a lot, the late Patricia Haight filed a FOIA a long time ago, and she got these internal working documents from the these BLM teams. And they were talking about, and many of the people that are currently in the BLM management, talking about mass euthanization of horses and how they'd have to get psychological counseling for people that had to do that. And I thought, oh, poor babies, shooting that many horses. And you know, even that book, Dayton Hyde's book, he talked about, you know, a BLM person coming over and telling him to shoot healthy horses. And they will do it. They will do it. So it's a very real threat.
Yeah, and I think that's something to be really clear about with your listeners. As I know that advocacy organizations, a lot of times we sound hyperbolic, right? We sound like we're saying it's the end of the world because we're trying to get people to act. But I have to say that this is a really – every year is difficult for wild horses because they don't have the same you know, they don't have the same expensive lobbyists and advocates that other interests, be it like cattle or energy interests, do. But this is potentially a really, really dark year in the history of America's wild horses and burros. And really the thing that's standing between this happening is really, you know, your listeners and people like them.
Yeah, it's only the public. That's all. That's all we've
exactly.
got, the public. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what can our listeners do to stop the slaughter? What can they do to try and stop this?
Right. So all advocacy organizations, I'm sure, are trying to make it as easy as possible, but I'll tell you how Return to Freedom is doing it. On the bottom of our homepage, there's a little item that says four things you can do today for wild horses and burros. And what's there is included is a targeted letter, which you fill it out. It'll go straight to your representatives in Congress. There are also links there that help you look up the phone number and mailing address of your congressional representatives. There's also a petition there for the SAFE Act being House Resolution 113, which is a bipartisan bill that would ban horse slaughter and the transportation of horses for slaughter. So those things are all in one place. I would say that we've reached the point now, we're coming up on a congressional break. So if you look at your congresswoman or congressman's website and you see that they're having a town hall or some other opportunity where you can go and talk to them, that would be outstanding. But in the meantime, you can send one of these targeted letters, and we recommend, you know, calling at least weekly, preferably once a day. It's particularly important if it turns out that your representative from your area turns out to be on the House Appropriations Committee. Those are the folks who really have their hands on the purse strings, and so the budget goes through them. And so all these budget provisions that we've been talking about have to go through them, as well as what we call the Horse Slaughter Defunding Amendment, which is an annual effort made by advocacy organizations to get Congress to not fund USDA inspectors for horse meat, because if you don't have horse meat inspectors, you can't have horse meat plants. And that's really the thin, believe it or not, the thin line between horse slaughter returning to the United States and horse slaughter remaining illegal. But going back to your original question, please pick up the phone. It only takes a couple of minutes. Call, leave a polite message. Remember, you're speaking on behalf of wild horses and burros, as angry as this may make you. And, you know, let them know who you are, where you're from, so they know that you're a constituent. You should only be calling your own representatives. You just tend to annoy other representatives if you call them. So call your own. Tell them who you are, where you're from. Tell them you're a constituent. Tell them why this matters with you. Tell them that you don't want that you want them to oppose any provisions in the budget that would reduce protections for wild horses and burros. And that's really all you have to do. It's actually pretty simple. And if you get – there is, because of healthcare and other issues, there's a good chance that you'll get a busy signal or a full voicemail box. And so when you look up those numbers on our website, they will also give you the district offices. And so you can call there instead And chances are you might actually have a better chance to have a conversation with some of the district staff and explain why this is important to you.
Yeah, like the local office instead of the DC office. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You and I talked about, and you know, this is where I try to impress upon people, every one of us makes a difference. We need all of it. The Wild Horses and Burros need all of us. They need each and every
Absolutely.
One of you. So, and what I did recently, I just had a couple of paragraphs, you know, suggested what people could say when they call the representatives. And I
right.
sent it to a bunch of my friends, and I said, please pass this along to your friends too. So, I mean, if we all did that, you know, even if you send it to five people, just, you know, say, please take 2 minutes out of your day sometime, or once a week if you could, and call, make a call, because we need to. We don't have the lobbyists
yeah.
that the special interests have. Corey,
Absolutely.
You and I were talking about – yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that's a fantastic idea. Really, the best, you know, the best word of mouth – you know, you have is your own network of friends and family, and to let them know why this is important to you, what they can do to call. It's a pretty easy thing to do is really important. It's the most powerful thing we can do. As you and I were saying before,
mm-hmm.
you know, these other sort of moneyed interests, there are all these other things on our public lands that reap some sort of revenue for somebody, and wild horses don't do that. And so wild horses don't have an army of lobbyists in expensive shoes. What they have is the people who are listening right now and the people who look on Facebook every day for new pictures of horses and things like that. That's the
mm-hmm.
voice they have.
And you know, people feel shy about calling. You can always even do a handwritten note and fax it to the fax number of your local congressional office or whatever. Just fax it. Because if they I think they count every letter as 100 people feel this way. So, you know, just anything. Just get the message, you know. We have to get the message out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Corey,
and old-fashioned snail mail works great.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's intimidating for people who haven't made that call before, but I assure you that the folks on the phone are quite pleasant. They actually probably want to get off the phone pretty quickly. They just want to, you know, check down who you are and what your position is. And so it's not like you're going to have to debate somebody over the phone about the future of wild horses and burros. You just have to state your position. And
yeah, you oppose the slaughter of wild horses and burros in the 2018 budget. You know,
Absolutely.
Even if you say that one sentence, you're opposing that. You know, please oppose that.
Yeah.
You know? Corey, you and I talked about the use of language, sort of whitewashing what's to happen. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's not a ton to say about it, except that what you're mm-hmm. seeing in these appropriations meetings is congressmen and senators from the West. And even the new Secretary of the Interior, talking a lot about sort of the tragedy of wild horses and burros. And they are making it sound as though the advocates are the ones who don't really care about the horses, and that, in fact, that what they're proposing is the humane thing, because these horses are all dying on the range, which isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And even if there were difficulties in some areas, and granted the drought has come and gone, there are things that you can do
they kind of forget to mention that the cattlemen that have their livestock grazing on the herd management areas, you know, are fencing off water sources from the wild horses too. I mean, there may be a couple of nice ones out there, but most of them, you know, they fence them off from water or from
and we don't know, you know, they'll brandish pictures of a dead horse and not say when it was taken and where it was taken.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you'll also see, like, a congressman from Utah in an appropriations meeting holding up pictures of what a certain chunk of land looked like 23 years ago. Well, you know, there have been, leaving aside even the cattle and horses for a minute, there have just been, since 2000, there have been like 3 droughts in Utah in that area. So,
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, and yet the horses are always they'll always find a way to blame the horses, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
getting back to your question about sort of the language, so they talk about what they are doing, which or what they're proposing, which would be shooting horses and selling them to people who will take them to slaughter. They're couching that in sort of humane language, and they use the word euthanasia because it sounds, you know, it sounds somehow more sterile and nice. But what it is shooting horses, and I think that's what people have to decide is
to slaughter in Mexico for really horrific, horrific deaths.
Yes. Yeah. Or as we've seen recently in Canada, being flown to Japan for slaughter, and also being treated very badly there. But I think you know, at the end of the day, the American people have to decide whether or not they want their taxpayer dollars used to shoot horses. And I don't think they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think they do either. So, how many acres have been removed from wild horse and burro habitat? You know, from when they started out in 1971, like, oh, this is their protected area. How many acres have been removed? Do you know?
22.2 million have been taken out. And then as you said, too, I think when you say these herd management areas, it sounds like, you know, there's an area designated for the horses and that's it. But as you noted, they're outnumbered by cattle even on the herd management areas that were created for horses.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
50-1.
Yeah, and you know, these areas were primarily for the use of the wild horses and burros. There could be other uses, but it was supposed to be primarily for their use. And what has been happening is just the opposite. It goes for every other use that makes a buck, and the wild horses are the first to get removed.
Yeah, so we've gone from 53.8 million acres. On acres of land where horses were found in 1971 when the act was passed to 26.9 million acres of land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners a bit about what's been happening with the AUMs?
Yeah, so to begin with, I guess always anytime we talk about AUM, we have to explain what it is. So an AUM is an animal unit month, as you well know. And an AUM equals one horse, one cow or calf pair, or five sheep. And so for 2016 on BLM lands, there were 12 million animal unit months, the equivalent of 1 million cow-calf pairs allocated for cattle. Authorized wild horse use on BLM lands was 320,580. So you can see the difference between 12 million animal unit months for cattle and 320,580 for horses.
Yeah. That's huge.
Yes.
How much does private livestock grazing on public lands cost American taxpayers each year? They're putting us in the red on that.
Right, absolutely. I think the number is 132 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too.
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I think that's about it. I think that it's what's really dramatic is the market rate for private land ranching is about $20 per animal per month, whereas the BLM is charging at $1.87. And that BLM charge is set by they set the formula for coming up with how much ranchers are charged on public lands way back in the 60s, and it has not been updated since.
Mm-hmm.
And so they continue to pay a tiny fraction of the amount that that other ranchers pay to have their cattle on private land, and that formula still has not changed, and so we're in this position where like only 3% of the nation's beef comes from public lands, and yet we're the wild horses are being pushed out repeatedly because of that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, basically this is over $1 billion a decade, and the thing that strikes me, all these livestock lobbying groups, special interest groups for livestock grazing, they have complained about the money spent on wild horses, you know, which is maybe $70 million, when actually they're almost they're putting this in the red almost double that, you know, a year.
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
Plus, don't they get even off the $1.87, don't they sometimes whittle that down a little bit? Like if they do range improvements, oh, you can pay 60 cents because, you know, you can spend the rest on range improvements. Somehow or another, there's subsidies they get on top, I mean, besides subsidies. But
I imagine that.
It's a whole racket when you get into that. And I'm just going to mention it quickly that people may not realize it. I keep trying to remind them that these livestock ranchers get bank loans based on a grazing permit. So that's like getting a bank loan. If you rent an apartment, it's like getting a bank loan on something you rent and you do not own. You know, they don't own the land they're grazing on. They act like they do in many cases, but they don't.
Yeah.
How much area has been taken away from? Did we talk about how many? I think we did talk about how many acres have been removed.
We did
talk
about acres.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to talk about, lobbyists. We don't have the lobbyists that these special interests do.
No, that's definitely the case. I mean, you have a small arm when it comes to, you know, cattle ranchers or energy interests are – I bring up energy interests in part not only because they – less because they're a direct – they have a direct impact on wild horses, although in this case they do because the president and the Secretary of Interior said that they want an all-of-the-above energy policy, and they're pushing for more mining, more drilling on public lands. And so what can happen, too, is that you have another species like the sage grouse that's affected, impacted by those other uses of public lands, and then you end up with a threatened species like the sage grouse pitted against another federally protected in another way, wild horse, and you end up, you know, with environmental groups and wild horse groups that can be, luckily it hasn't happened much, but you can conceive of a situation where they're pitted against each other while the moneyed interests are, you know, walking away with cash. So there aren't, so horses don't have that great army of lobbyists, at least not in the traditional sense. What we have is the American people who time and again, whether it was dating back to Wild Horse Annie and the passage of the 1971 Act, and time and again when people have been given the opportunity to speak up on behalf of wild horses, they've done it. And we think they'll do it again this year.
We hope so. Yeah, we're working for it. Can you tell us a little bit about slaughter statistics from 2008 to 2015?
Sure. Yeah. You keep asking me about unhappy things.
I'm sorry.
but it's important. It is important to know. From 2008 to 2015, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, an average of 127,000 horses a year were taken to Mexico or Canada for slaughter. And I think, you know, we don't know how many wild horses fall into the pipeline. You sort of hear different numbers at different times. But the SAFE Act, which you mentioned before, is intended to protect both human health as well as horse health because horses in the United States are not raised to be eaten. So they're filled with medications of various sorts. And so when you think about the horses that fall into the slaughter pipeline, they're, you know, horses that were raised as pets, horses that were raised as thoroughbreds. And they're filled with all sorts of stuff that we shouldn't be eating either. And so last I looked, the House bill, the SAFE Act, had 135 co-sponsors. And again, it's from both parties. And it's a bill that's been pushed every year, year after year after year, and we haven't quite gotten it over the hill. But it's, you know, all we can do as supporters of wild horses and supporters of American horses in general is to keep pushing the boulder, keep trying to get people to listen, because the U.S. is not and never has been a horse-eating country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of us, anyhow, the vast majority of us. Can you talk a little bit, now this budget, you were talking about some comparisons between this budget and past budgets.
Sure.
Like the 2016 budget.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the in 2016 you were looking at a 80.5 million dollars was the total enacted budget for the Wild Horse and Burro program, and now we're talking about cutting $12 million out of that, I believe, or $9.7 million, excuse me, 12% of the
mm-hmm.
budget. So it's a pretty significant cut. It is not, believe it or not, it's not as big as some of the cuts across other departments, but when you're talking about a budget whose so much of the Wild Horse and Burro program budget is wrapped up in the care of real live animals, those percentages mean a lot more.
Yeah, they're warehousing them. Can you talk a little bit about the cost per day, comparing long-term holding to short-term holding per day per horse, or tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. So long-term holding, these are these pastures that are often in the Midwest. They'll rent. Those are about $2.42 per day per horse. Shorter-term holding, that's more kind of the more of a corral. That's $4.11 per day. And the cost per day to taxpayers is $135,424 a day that we're spending on maintaining horses and holding facilities. And what we in Return to Freedom and other advocates believe is that that's money that could be spent on all kinds of different humane range management that would allow wild horses and burros to have a sustainable future on the range. We can end this whole broken, expensive cycle of helicopter roundups and capture and dividing up of family bands and horses being put in short and long-term holding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Return to Freedom, like how many horses you have there, locations, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Return to Freedom, as you said, you did a lovely introduction for us, and I appreciate that. So we've been around since around 1997. We have more than 500 horses now at four locations in California, two on California's Central Coast and two in Northern California. The two on the Central Coast are open to the public for either private tours and photo safaris, as well as we're in the midst of our summer visiting season, and so the last Saturday of every month we're open to visitors, and year-round also on the last Saturday of every month year-round we have volunteer days. And we're fortunate enough to have some wonderful volunteers in the area, and sometimes even from out of the area, who come and want to spend a day doing some things that will benefit the horses. And so I mentioned more than 500 horses. We also have 44 wonderful burros. And the two locations that are open, one is in near Lompoc, California, which is near Andrews Air Force Base. And or Vandenberg, excuse me, and just up the road and near San Luis Obispo, there's a wonderful family there who, through our Wild Horse Conservator Program, has allowed us to put a group of our horses onto 2,000 acres that are just, it's really horse heaven. You can see the Pacific Ocean from on top of the hill and stand up there with, you know, a group of 50 horses. It's a pretty magical place to be.
And then you have the locations up north. Yeah, I have a quick story I want to put in here about Netta's generosity. About 5 years ago, I was at a roundup in Nevada, and you know, when they first round up the horses, they put them in these small temporary corrals, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, and the BLM, you know, tapes off a little area where observers can stand to watch observe what's happening. So all day long, there was this one mare that kept staring. She came in with her little colt, and a stallion. So all day long, if I stood at the left of this area, she never took her eyes off of me hardly the whole time. If I moved to the left, she watched me. If I moved to the right, she watched me. So naturally, by the end of the day, I went up to the PR person for the BLM and I said, I want to adopt those three horses. And I don't have a yard even, much less, you know, a big place to put them. So I actually begged Denise to call Netta and ask if Netta could take the horses. And Netta very generously agreed. So she's got those horses. That mare that was looking at me all day, I just had to get a home for her. So that's a little side story about Netta and her generosity.
Well, and really that's what, you know, what Return to Freedom is all about is, one, Netta wanted to create a model for how wild horses and burros could be managed on the range, and to create an educational opportunity for the public. But the other thing that's really kind of, you know, one of our, you know, North Stars, if you will, is the fact that horses are, you know, intelligent, sentient beings that have very rich social lives. And so Return to Freedom is all built around the idea of keeping family bands together. And even on the rare, we don't adopt out many horses, but like on the rare occasions that we do, they tend to be adopted out in groups. And we're very strict about where they go. But for instance, mm-hmm. we just had a pair of burros, Rosie and Lola, but they went together to some folks who live nearby here. And so they have a wonderful life and we keep track of them. Mm-hmm. But that idea of, and this is what, you know, part of what we pitch so frequently to BLM is keeping herds and family bands together. Because one of the first things they do right now, the helicopters chase the horses into the trap, and the first things they do are divided up by age and gender. And, you know, the horse not only loses everything it's ever known in terms of the range, but it also loses its family. And,
yeah, it's horrible. I've been to more roundups, and it's horrible. It's really gut-wrenching.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We can talk about a little happy thing now. Can you tell us about the Gila Herd Project?
Yeah. So the Gila Herd is a herd of, I would say, 112 horses, but the number keeps going up. because we have, I think we've had 12 or 13 foals. But the story of the Gila Herd is they were part of a sanctuary in South Dakota where they were found to be neglected, and we and other organizations and individuals were part of a rescue of it. It turned out to be about 907 horses, which we believe is the largest rescue of its kind in the United States. And Return to Freedom, we did a number of things that were involved in the rescue, but the thing that you're mentioning now, the Gila Herd, is a group of 112 horses that are derived from a group of 31 that originally came from Arizona. And back around 2000, they were rounded up by the BLM. They were taken by this rescue group to South Dakota, and then over time multiplied. And so we've taken responsibility for that specific herd, and we moved them 1,200 miles or so to Fallon, Nevada, where they received coggins, and they had their feet trimmed and all of those things and all the shots they needed. And then they were moved another, starting with the mares and foals, they were moved about 4 hours northwest into onto a private pasture. It's 1,800 acres in Northern California, and a big group of stallions and geldings recently joined them. So there's about 80 or 90 horses up there that are have gone in the last year from surviving blizzards and cold in South Dakota to dusty corrals in Nevada to now having these amazing, expansive green pastures and hills covered in pine trees and ponds, and it's really a beautiful place for them to be. Mm-hmm. What's next for the herd, we're not entirely sure. Our first job was to take care of the rescue and get them into a safe place. We are doing DNA testing, working with Texas A&M University to sort of figure out the herd's viability and try to make a plan for what comes next. There may be adoptions. There may be if a landowner or a significant donor steps forward, you know, there may be the possibility of keeping a large portion of the herd together. At this point, we don't know. We're just trying to get them fat and healthy and happy again, and so far, so good.
Good, good. We went way past, we're way past the half hour, so I wanted to remind our listeners, if you'd like to call in with any questions for Corey, just call in at area code 917-388-4520, and then press 1, and if you have any questions. So if someone wants to come tour Return to Freedom, how do they do that?
Yeah.
You can just sign up online or just show up on, what was it, the last Saturday of the month? Or
so if you go to returntofreedom.org, our webpage, at the very top, there is a menu for a little spot for the visit page. You click on that, and that will tell you about all our upcoming events. That includes the tours on the last Saturday of the month during the summer. It includes the volunteer days that run year-round on the last Saturday of the month. But we also have special events. Unfortunately, some of those have passed. For instance, in June, we have a family day that's aimed more at little kids. We have and then we have special events like we have a photo workshop that's about to start, and I'm not sure if it's full yet or not, but it might be very close, with renowned equine photographer and Return to Freedom board member Tony Stromberg will be leading photo safaris there. He's a fantastic person to learn from. We also have coming up in August, we'll have horse training as well with Linda Salinas, who teaches the Carolyn Resnick method, which is really fantastic, sort of liberty-oriented horsemanship. And so we have lots of stuff. And then we have people can apply to we can't take a lot because we don't have a ton of space, but you can also apply to be an in-residence volunteer. For instance, this summer we have a recent University of Cincinnati photojournalism graduate with a lot of horse background who's spending our summer with us, and she's doing photography work, but she's also leading tours and spending time with horses, and so those opportunities are there as well under both the visit and get involved tabs on our website.
Yeah, good. I think I've heard a couple of bells ring, so I think we have a couple of people calling in with questions. Marty?
I believe Neda has joined you.
Oh, good. Neda.
Hi.
Hello. Are you
there?
Hi. Oh, yeah, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Yeah, we can
hear you. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, we can hear you really well. Well, I'll just, since I haven't had a chance to ask you any questions, I'll give Corey a break. Can you tell us a little bit about founding Return to Freedom back in 1997?
Yeah, I started out, you know, wanting to create something that would add value to a situation that it hadn't hit critical mass for sure, and very few people even knew that America still had wild horses free ranging on our public land. So I was wanting to make a difference, and I knew Jim Clapp and Diane Nelson, who was then his wife, and they had started the Wild Horse Sanctuary in Shingletown together. And I took people up there and wanted to look for solutions that weren't being addressed. And so after a few years, I started Return to Freedom, and I wanted to, I guess our first fundamental message was that horses live in bands, horses live in herds, is really the important point that I think was being missed. People were looking at the issue and thinking the solution was adoption. And I was, everywhere I looked, it looked like a very uncertain fate for these horses that had been through so much. And so when I started Return to Freedom years later, you know, the first thing we addressed was trying to keep the family bands together and to really shift the whole perception and the vernacular on the issue. And I'm happy to look around today and see that a lot of the concepts and the verbiage that we were using then is now becoming more of the common vernacular and context with which we
approach. Like maintaining natural herd groups. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
We do have some callers calling in with some questions. Marty, can you have them hold on just for a few minutes so I can just ask Netta one or two more questions and then we'll take questions?
All right.
Okay.
We can do that.
Yeah. Netta, so can you tell us a little bit about some of your horse herds, or some wild horse herds have historical and cultural and genetic significance? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, when I first started, we were working with horses that were coming off Fish and Wildlife refuges, because Jim Clapp was a contractor who was removing horses for Fish and Wildlife and on horseback. And so we were able to keep the family bands together and relocate them along with bachelor bands to the sanctuary. And knowing that we couldn't save them all, we thought that that was a good way to go, so that we could have people to sit and observe quietly natural herd behavior. And quite soon, we knew we had to address reproduction. So that became something that, you know, what are your options? You know what I mean? They're sell babies, adopt babies, separate stallions, geld stallions, ovarectomies, permanent sterilization of some kind, or selling it to an unknown, who knows, and or slaughter. And so we, you know, obviously we went with what the Science and Conservation Center had been doing for over 20 years. And there was a lot of data, and so we went with the native PZP vaccine, and, you know, that's how we managed the herds. As things rolled, and the horses up at Heart Mountain, we did check a couple of them, and they had a lot of Spanish bloodline and a lot of diversity. Sheldon had a lot of horses from Cavalry Remont stock that had bred with, you know, draft breeds that came over from Europe later than the Spaniards, et cetera. And so as we moved along, you know, the horses educated me, you know, and I became more aware of the diversity and the needs. And as people who had been trying to preserve or conserve some of the early Spanish-Iberian lines that made up what we call the Spanish Mustang, and we realized that, you know, some of those people were running out of money and they had these horses. They were typically they were breeders and they were breeding and selling. So over time, some of those horses came into our awareness and had a need, and we created a conservation program for the Choctaw, which is by Dr. Sponenberg's own words, a genetic rescue project. They have very rare color genetics that will all but be lost. They go back to the original horses that came with DeSoto and carried the Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw tribes on the Trails of Tears, and had been, you know, pretty undiluted, and very few remain. And then we had, you know, obviously the Sulphur Springs herd came out of Utah, and there's still some of them remaining, and they just did a roundup this year. When I started, there were only maybe a little over 100 to 200 of them left at that time, but through reproduction on the range, they had gotten their population back up again. So the roundup continued this year, which is very sad. But we will be taking some of them as well at some point. Our herd is getting older. And then the Wilbur Cruz herd. And so some of the early Spanish colonial horses that had been the foundation of what we called the Spanish Mustang in America are also at the sanctuary. And the reason I did the DBA called the American Wild Horse Sanctuary is because none of these horses is more important than the other. That is not the message. The message is that we want to educate the people about what is the American Mustang. And the American Mustang is as diverse and broad as the American people. And what very few people really know or accept, especially because politically it's unacceptable, is that the horse as a species originated and went through all its adaptations on this continent. Nowhere else in the entire world have they found the diversity and the prolific fossils that tell the story of the horse, as in America. And so, you know, going even back to their last adaptation to the one-hoofed horse, the genus Equus caballus, which we know today as the modern cavalling horse, that happened you know, 1.5 to 2 million years ago in North America, prior to their believed extinction 10,000 years ago. So whether they were completely extinct after the last ice age and only returned again domestic through, you know, with the Spanish and the early ethnic Chinese and Mongolians, that doesn't matter. The horse went through that adaptation here on this continent. And if they left and re-returned domesticated, they were returning home again. So the horses that returned to a natural state here over the last few hundred years, we celebrate them as a returned native species. And that is why we have a conservation program. That's why we want to represent the spectrum of the American horse, the American wild horse, the American free-roaming horse, the American Mustang at the sanctuary. And that's the gist of it. I mean, I can get more into it, but that's the overview, I think.
One thing I wanted to ask you, too, just to make this point. Wild horses are ecologically beneficial, and they also, they're kind of, they provide fire protection. So there's a lot of benefits to wild horses on our public lands.
Absolutely. You know, the wild horse was, you know, in 1971, the act declared that the horses were important for the spirit of the American people, and the pioneering represented the pioneering spirit of the West, and that they were important. They contributed to the ecological diversity, and they do today. The problem, the issue and the challenges that our horses are facing is purely driven by economics and not science. So this is why this is why people like us care, like you, like me, like Corey, like many advocates around the country. We care so deeply because the horses have been, you know, persecuted with unfair propaganda that's driven by profit industries that monopolize our public lands and our natural resources. And it's that that's all it is.
Yeah.
They've been fighting their last stand since the 1950s and even before that. And today they are facing just as great a challenge as they did then. And to lose all the work that we have gained and that we have fought to try to keep some of it from slipping away, even though the act has been gutted since its inception in 1971, what little remains for their protection, we will fight for, because I do not believe that the American people would live to stand to see the, you know, the bloodbath that would happen if we lose those protections through the lifting of sale restriction for sale authority, adoptions, and to lift the ban on slaughter for all of America's horses while they're domestic. But I think that is just not an American sentiment in any way, shape, or form. And, I mean, my God, you know, you can hear the passion in our voices just starts to raise here, okay?
Yeah. We have a couple of questions. We've had some people waiting for a little bit, Netta, so let's jump in. Let's let them ask a couple of questions. And then I still have a couple of questions I want to get back and ask. Marty,
we had one caller staying down, area code 540. You're live and on the air.
Hello, this is Brittany.
Hi, Brittany. Did you have a question?
Yes, I did. By the way, I just wanted to let Netta know that I met her at Briarfest 2010.
Hey,
and
Brittany.
We got.
Yes.
You remember me?
Yes, I do.
Awesome. Nice to hear from you. Anyways, I'm going to make this short because I know that there's other people calling in. I heard that something with the budget with the wild horses is going to be coming up in about a couple of weeks. Is that true?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, Corey, probably I missed the first half. I'm in traffic, and Corey has been on the line talking a lot about that. Corey, did you want to overview her? Brittany, I remember Brittany very well. Didn't you move out west or go to school out west? Didn't you end up coming through?
Yes, we just moved to Arizona. And I'm about to start college with the equine care and management and all that, and I really look forward to it.
Oh, my God, fantastic.
And I also plan on going to Return to Freedom this summer, hopefully the volunteer day in July. Will you happen to be there?
Should be there. Yes, Yes, I should be.
Okay, great. I'm sorry. I'm getting. I'm veering off topic. Anyway,
so Corey,
would you happen
Corey can,
to?
Corey can let you know what to do.
Yeah. So Brittany, without to save the time for the other questions that we might have, the other questions that Debbie has, if you go to our homepage and you scroll to the very bottom, there's an item that says four things you can do for wild horses. And it will link to you to information about the president's budget, which would remove protections for wild horses, and it will give you some steps that you can take, including calling your representatives in Washington to help oppose that.
Okay, Marty, thanks for calling in, Brittany. Marty, do we have another caller with a question?
We just had two drop off while they waited, so go ahead on, Deb.
Okay. So, Netta, another thing is, can you tell us a little bit, is Return to Freedom thinking about some kind of a wild horse and wildlife land trust or a conservancy, wilderness preserve, something like that? Is that on the horizon with Return to Freedom?
Yeah, it always is, since the day we started. It's been an interesting ride, but definitely – we are always looking to, we're continuing, and we stopped for a few years while we regrouped due to challenges. And now we are definitely pursuing, expanding to a larger preserve with a more of a national learning center. And we have some conversations that we're in the middle of right now. Another exciting thing that's happened over the last few years is one of our donors did open up 2,000 acres in San Luis Obispo to us, which has been just so fulfilling for them and their family, but also it has saved us about $10,000 a month in feed costs. And the horses have enough of diversity on the terrain for their feet to be trimmed, and it's just been a real amazing experience. And so Corey and I were talking, and we said, let's formalize a program to help people who have land, because we have 20 years of expertise on the ground, to open up some of our people that we know that have various talents and skills, and us to be consultants to help them establish, a management plan or a program or all of the above for their ranch and train their staff or what have you. And so we have a wild horse conservator program, and that's just it's been something that we've been wanting to do, and we're doing it more. So now we have another donor that's opening up 1,000 acres. But those are near us, so they still are going to be drawing a lot from us overseeing the horses. We're also wanting it to expand to people that are just have their own staff, and we can help place horses. If some of the things happen that the Secretary of Interior and the new director of the BLM say they want to do, the horses are going to need as many resources as they can. So to that end, we have now, we are just hiring a lobbyist to work with us on some legislation and some solutions that we've been talking about for a long time to help open the door for those things, which will if we can push some things through, it would help open up solutions on the other end of this thing as well. So yes,
and people,
individual people
can even sponsor a horse that's at Return to Freedom now, correct?
Absolutely. We have many horses that need, if every horse was sponsored, we would be able to meet our operating budget every year and focus on more of the policy reform and other solutions that we desperately need to do. And I wanted to address some of the things Corey, I know, was waiting for me to jump on the call about the Gila herd. We absolutely are adopting horses from the Gila herd. We have just moved about 20 of 23 males that were gelded that are 5 years old and under that are now, we moved to Lompoc. And as soon as we get their feet trimmed again, they've all been vaccinated and all those good things. And they are real sweet. And they are going to be made available to people who conform or accept and qualify through Return to Freedom's terms and conditions. We have a pretty strict adoption policy, and we will stick by our policies through this adoption process. And we also have stallions that were gelded and turned back out with the mares that are five and older and those horses in their natural, as we watch the bands kind of reform and regroup, if people who have, as Corey was saying, land resources would like to be custodians of some of the bands, that just to live out their lives with each other, we would be interested in their applications as well for those. That would be more of a conservator, a conservatorship.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Good. What was I going to ask? I had a question right on the top of my head, and another train of thought left with the station. What are some of the educational programs for Return to Freedom is offered to the public?
I don't know if Corey delved into it. We do, all of our tours are educational by their very nature, because we really get into deeper into some of the conversation that we just overviewed. And then we also have the in-residence program, and we just have someone who just arrived from Italy who we are interviewing for the next 2 months. She'll be here with a deep background in, as an animal behaviorist and a wild horse behaviorist and other skills that she has to help us develop more structure around our educational programs for the in-residence volunteers while they're there. So we have that. We have, we have various clinicians come in and bring their good work to Return to Freedom, and we feature them. People like Linda Salinas, for example, probably Angie Dawn Murray will do some work there. We've had Andrea Kutch and her academy, and she's going to continue to work there. And June Gunther has brought her wonderful clients there in the past with Teaching Horse for she does wonderful work on her her program.
Netta, we've got less than a minute left. The show's flown by, but I wanted to thank both you and Corey for being on the show tonight. And so everyone go to returntofreedom.org, and remember, go to the Corey. It's the four things people can do at the bottom, right?
Absolutely. It's at the bottom. It's at the bottom of the page right now, and it's an easy step-by-step thing that people can do to make a difference when it comes to both the budget and to horse slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, everybody, go to returntofreedom.org and contact your congressional leaders and tell them you oppose the slaughter of wild horses and burros. Thank you, Netta and Corey, for being on the show. I'd like to thank my producer, Marty Oakley, and TS Radio has two other... TS Radio has two other shows, Whistleblowers, hosted by Marty Oakley on Thursday nights, and Voices Carried for Animals, hosted by Debbie Dahmer on Tuesday nights. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.